Bland, of course, comes to mind, who was pulled over, the police officer said, for failing to signal a lane change and ends up dead in her jail cell because she couldn't raise the bond money to get out 3 days later. We're wrapping up with this comment, Mary Hooks. Mary, with your comment on women like Sandra and who you're trying to save.
You know, for women like Sandra, for women like Sandra, for women like myself, for the women like my family members and my comrades and folks who are, we are bailing out, for people who don't get killed by police in that interaction, the slow death happens in the cage. And so our hope is that this action inspires other folks to take action, to know that we can take down this cash bail system, to know we can get our people out of cages right now. There's a long-term fight ahead of us in terms of ending the cash bail system.
Mary, we're going to continue this discussion in the coming days. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Mary Hooks, co-director of Southerners on New Ground and an organizer of National Black Mamas Bailout Day. That does it for the show. I'll be speaking in New York tonight at the New School at Tishman Auditorium at 7 p.m. free to the public here in New York. On Saturday, I'll be in Olympia, Washington, and then at Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon. Sunday will be in Eureka and Berkeley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronik. Happy to be with you today from WHFR.fm, the station making waves, live from Henry Ford College, although the college is now on its four-day spring and summer semester work week. So Fridays, the campus is closed, as it is on Saturdays, too, by the way, and Sundays. But, of course, WHFR, we're 24-7, so they make sure that our electricity and our air conditioning, heating, whatever is needed, is going for us. So we're the only full-time game in town right now. But I will say that it's not just everybody has an extra vacation. Oh, those teachers, they get so much vacation. Stuff is happening, nonetheless, like our maintenance crews and renovation projects are going strong, and things are getting cleaned up and repainted and fixed up for the fall semester. And this is a great time to do it, too, because, well, they can use the Fridays and not have to give overtime to workers. Plus, you don't have the problems in certain classrooms of trying to work and repair things around classes and students. Plus, a lot of workmen would prefer not to work in the middle of the night. And some projects take several days, so it days and nights to complete. So it actually was a great idea, a cost-saving measure. And since we do offer not quite as many classes in the spring and summer semesters, then it does give us that extra space to do an extra, makes that other possibilities happen. So don't come by on Fridays, but if you are coming to WHFR, be sure to call ahead. And, of course, the phone systems are not super reliable right now here. We're running some checks on them. Our usual main number is 313-845-9676, but we're not certain that everybody gets through all the time to either the live studio, the one I'm broadcasting from, of course, or the office side. So we do have another number, too, if you want to take it down, that does come in live studio. I don't take calls during my show, however, unless it's something I've planned ahead, like a guest or something by phone. But just so you know, you can get a DJ in Studio A by calling directly 313-317-4130. That's the WHFR direct line into Studio A, our live studio, 313-317-4130. If you have any other need for information about WHFR, don't forget our website, whfr.fm. Oh boy, is there information there. Well, Sunday, coming up Sunday, is Mother's Day in the United States. And around the world, it's recognized somewhat differently and sometimes on slightly different days. But it's always interesting for me to share the actual background of it. Of course, there's nothing wrong with honoring our mothers. Each of us needed a mother to give birth to us. And by golly, here we are. So certainly, we thank all of our mothers for going through the 9 months of pregnancy and delivery. That's not an easy physical thing to do. Yes, women are designed for it, someone might say, but nonetheless, it's physically very tough and tougher for some than others, but still, it's wonderful. And of course, the mothering that goes on after you're born from your mother and hopefully father too and other relatives, friends even, is also important in the development of all of us. So everybody really should be thanked who's ever has done any parenting, officially or unofficially, of course. But the history of Mother's Day in the United States is kind of interesting. The credit usually goes for establishing it to an Anna Jarvis. And the first official Mother's Day was celebrated at St. Andrew's Methodist Church in Grafton, West Virginia on May 10th, 1908. However, a little background here. It was actually Anna's mother that came up with the idea in 1868, created a committee to establish a Mother's Friendship Day, the purpose of which was to reunite families that had been divided during the Civil War. Why do we have a Civil War, by the way? Does anybody know? I mean, that should have been able to be worked out, right? No. Of course, I was ironically mentioning a quote from our current president of the United States. It's slavery. And of course, the culture that surrounded it and the economic situation of the so-called Confederate states that didn't want to give, certainly not equal rights and freedoms to black people, their slaves. That's a pretty easy answer. I hope all of you knew the answer to that question, even though apparently our current president of the United States didn't know that. And how difficult it is to change a cultural system once it's in place for decades. That's why you can't just make a deal. Anyway, Ann Jarvis, the mother of Anna Jarvis, had previously organized a Mother's Day work clubs to improve sanitation and health for both Union and Confederate encampments undergoing a typhoid outbreak and wanted to expand this into an annual memorial day for mothers, but she died in 1905 before the celebration became popular. So the daughter, who the article here says became almost obsessed with her, would continue her mother's efforts. Well, it's interesting, and she did continue, of course, until there was the observance in 19. She started. Her mother died in 1905, and she was able to get that first service officially done in 1908, it did spread to other cities, but wasn't an official holiday of the United States until. The U.S. Congress did pass a resolution asking then President, this is in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson to designate the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day. And he did that. And so it is a national holiday on the second Sunday every May as Mother's Day. And Wilson, in his proclamation, indicated it was a day for American citizens to show the flag in honor of those mothers whose sons had died in war. Interestingly, not all mothers. So, I mean, technically, legally, it's not a U.S. national holiday honoring all mothers. It's just mothers whose sons have died in war. And, of course, Wilson did get us involved with. And was it 1914, I think, is when it started, right? That is World War One we're talking about. Now, maybe we didn't enter for a couple of years. Yeah, I think that was it. And talking about war, oh, by the way, and Anna Jarvis, the daughter of the woman who had this first idea of a Mother's Day to help the wounded soldiers, especially of the Civil War, she, after the holiday came out, she totally claimed that she was the one, gave no credit to her mother. So if she was so obsessed with her mother, why did she want to grab all the credit for it? And she is recognized now in just about every history book. Oh, Mother's Day was the idea of Anna Jarvis. But in fact, it was her mother. And then, of course, the idea changed a little bit when it became a national holiday. But originally, there was back in 1872, one of the women's rights suffragette movement leaders, Julia Ward Howe, that's H-O-W-E, wrote a Mother's Day proclamation. And I'm going to read it for you. In 1872, she asked for the celebration of a Mother's Day for peace. That was the whole idea. The statement and her effort was a pacifist reaction to the carnage of the American Civil War and the then Franco-Prussian War, France and Poland, France and Germany, back in the 1870s, 1880s. Anyway, the appeal was tied to Howe's feminist conviction that women had a responsibility to shape their societies at the political level. And so she wanted this Mother's Day for peace on June 2nd of every year, but she was unsuccessful. Nonetheless, here is her statement from Julia Ward Howe, the Mother's Day Proclamation. Again, in the sight of the Christian world, have the skill and power of two great nations exhausted themselves in mutual murder. Again, have the sacred questions of international justice been committed to the fatal mediation of military weapons. In this day of progress, in this century of light, the ambition of rulers has been allowed to barter the dear interests of domestic life for the bloody exchanges of the battlefield. Thus men have done. Thus men will do. But women need no longer be made a party to proceedings which fill the globe with grief and honor. And honor, no, not at all. Excuse me, the word is horror. Which fill the globe with grief and horror. Despite the assumptions of physical force, the mother has a sacred and commanding word to say to the sons who owe their life to her suffering. That word should now be heard and answered as never before. Arise then, Christian women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of tears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agency. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, women of one country, will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence vindicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first, as women, to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace. Man is the brother of man, each bearing after its own kind the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and of humanity, I earnestly ask that a General Congress of Women without limit of nationality be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and at the earliest period consistent with its objects to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace. Those are the words of Julia Ward Howe, written in 1870, asking for a Mother's Day for peace 2 years later, but that didn't happen that way. Certainly, it's a strong statement, and no one is against peace, I assume. Some people think you have to fight others and kill them in order to have peace. I'm not of that persuasion. Many of you know that I'm a practicing pacifist in numerous ways, not necessarily religious pacifism. Just ethical, moral pacifism. Here's a statement from an organization I am a member of, Pax Christi USA. It is a Catholic organization. Sometimes differs with the some of the statements of the Catholic Church, the Pope, but not Pope Francis in this case. Pope Francis has been very much in step with the positions of Pax Christi USA, for example. And here's a letter they issued just yesterday, Thursday, May 11th. Today is, if I didn't mention at the start of the show, Friday, May the 12th, 2017. They state here in the letter that they co-sponsored and attended the Nuclear Weapons Conference, which was entitled Toward a Fundamental Change in Nuclear Weapons Policy, organized by Soka Gakkai International USA. And they wanted to share some resources. And they made the statement, there's a false sense of security that exists with having and acquiring nuclear weapons that the U.S. and eight other nuclear weapon-holding countries currently buy into. The problematic idea is that the threat of mutually assured destruction deters nations from ever using these bombs. This is nonsense, says Pax Christi. Deterrence is a myth, and the risk of insane heads of state being in charge of nuclear arsenals, accidental nuclear war due to incorrect intelligence, or nuclear malfunctions are too deadly to chance. Climate scientist Dr. Alan Robach gave a horrifying and fascinating presentation at this conference. And was entitled Climate Disruption from Limited Nuclear War. He calculated the devastating consequences of 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs, less than 1% of the current world's nuclear weapons, being used in a hypothetical conflict between India and Pakistan. 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs are like bringing 100 pieces of the sun to Earth, and everything and everyone in nuclear wake would be immediately destroyed. The devastation of these weapons would take 100 million lives instantly, but the long-lasting effect on the climate would take billions. Billions of lives. The atmosphere, and we've only got 7 billion on this planet. The atmosphere would be left with tons and tons of ash and smoke that will remain for over a decade. That's the so-called nuclear winter you may have heard about, talked about for a couple decades, and totally verified by other climate scientists, too. The sun's warmth would be blocked by this ash and smoke. Temperatures would plummet to ice age levels. There would be massive famine, and billions would die of starvation. This doom and gloom is a real threat, and this scenario isn't even the worst that can happen. If you want more information about this, by the way, it's Rachel Schmidt, who's the communications coordinator of Pax Christi USA, who wrote this letter that I'm on their mailing list, and I got to yesterday. But if you want more information, it's paxchristiusa.org. That's PAXCHRISTIUSA, Pax Christi USA. By the way, Pax Christi began in the 1960s, and it was first organized right here in the Detroit area. Yep. Father Thomas Hinsberg was the priest who was the leader at that time and helped form, with others, Pax Christi, which became Pax Christi USA. As long as we're on that topic, not just pacifism, but war, which is still going on. I mean, this article will point that out. This is the opinion, and he usually has a well-written editorial comment that he has on his website. This is from Ralph Nader. His website is easy to remember, nader.org, N-A-D-E-R.org. And his essay is not too long. I'm going to share it with you in detail since it is Mother's Day on Sunday. And the original idea was to have it Mother's Day to honor the mothers that helped the damage that was done to our soldiers, to our sons, not so much daughters years ago, in all these wars. And that it's entitled, the essay is entitled by Ralph Nader, The Losing Warfare State. You've heard of the welfare state, right? Yeah. This is the losing warfare state. And Ralph Nader says, the USA is still bogged down in Afghanistan. The 16-year-old occupation is the longest in American history. And in Iraq, since the unconstitutional and illegal invasion of the country 14 years ago. With about 30,000 poorly equipped fighters, the Taliban has held down a U.S.-equipped and trained Afghan army 8 times larger in soldiers. Plus, the U.S. forces, fluctuating from 100,000 at its peak to 8,500 now, plus contractors, that's mercenary soldiers, with advanced air, sea, and land weaponry that is second to none. Moreover, the Taliban has been advancing, controlling 30 to 40% of the country and a third of the population, according to the Wall Street Journal. In Iraq, the U.S. had hundreds of thousands of soldiers and contractors during the Bush years. Yet today, the country is still in the throes of a civil war, where a previously non-existent threat, ISIS, with less than 15,000 fighters, has been successfully resisting a huge Iraqi army backed by U.S. trainers and Air Force. How can this be? Asks Ralph Nader. Quote, we are vulnerable, unquote, writes military author William Greeter. He goes on, because our presumption of unconquerable superiority leads us deeper and deeper into unwinnable military conflicts, unquote. Jim Fallows asserts in the Atlantic news periodical monthly that our military, quote, is the best equipped fighting force in history, also better trained, motivated, and disciplined than during the draft army years, unquote. Nonetheless, he concludes, quote, yet repeatedly this force has been defeated by less modern, worse equipped, barely funded foes, or it has won skirmishes and battles only to lose and get bogged down in a larger war. Mr. Nader goes on, it gets worse. Less than 3,000 ISIS fighters took sudden control in 2013 of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city with over 1 million residents. Notwithstanding being vastly outnumbered by the Iraqi military and police, who fled, ISIS went on to control over a third of Iraq's land area. Iraqis and U.S. forces are now destroying West Mosul in order to save it from a few hundred remaining ISIS fighters. Fallows quotes former military intelligence officer Jim Gourley as saying, quote, it is incontrovertibly evident that the U.S. military failed to achieve any of its strategic goals in Iraq, unquote. Setting aside the fundamental questions about why we invaded Iraq and continued to occupy Afghanistan long after 9/11, Americans are entitled to question, how continued American occupations across the Middle East serve any kind of vital national interest, and why they continue to fail. In his analysis, military historian Thomas Ricks writes that, quote, an important factor in the failure is that no one gets relieved by the military brass for combat ineffectiveness. Nobody gets fired. Okay. But there are other reasons all the way up the chain of command. Cargo planes ship $100 bills in bulk to Kabul, or is it Kabul? Kabul Airport as part of an extensive bribery extortion system that weakens the opposition to the Taliban, whose appeal to the masses, despite their harsh rule over them, is to drive out the foreign invaders. That's a very powerful motivation, one that is lacking among Afghan forces and politicians, whom the people of Afghanistan view as puppets of the U.S. and its Western allies. Retired Admiral Mike Mullen makes another point concerning, quote, the growing disconnect between the American people and our military. He observes that fewer and fewer American citizens know anyone in the military. It's become just too easy to go to war. I would, unquote, I would add that in this area, which is one of the reasons I do stories about the wars in the Middle East and so on, we have a lot of people who may not have sons or daughters fighting the war in the Middle East right now, but have relatives there in this area in particular. And so this is a vital concern to those in this local area, but I think it should be for the entire United States. Why are we at war? The ease at which we embrace military interventions is in large part due to a gross dereliction of duty on the part of the Congress, Ralph Nader goes on to say, which allows the White House to commence wars, large and small, without legal authority. Congress is the only branch of government constitutionally authorized to declare war and appropriate funds for war. The Libyan war, which was pushed by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and opposed by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, by the way, was waged without seeking either legal authority or funds from the legislative branch. The Obama administration took monies from the unauditable, that is, nobody could track the money, Pentagon budget to start that continuing disaster in Libya and neighboring African countries. Listening to the House and Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, one finds a sycophancy and level of questioning by the lawmakers of Pentagon officials that would embarrass a mediocre high school student. But the senators and representatives have their reasons. They simply do not want the responsibility for military action, except to provide a virtual blank check from the taxpayers for the department. That is the Department of Defense, mislabeled Department of Defense, because most of the time they're on the offense, by the way. And that's my comment on the side. Oh, by the way, all opinion, including Ralph Nader's opinion, take a little aside here to mention this, including yours truly's opinion, are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, faculty, staff, students, or administrators. Continuing. He says the Department of Defense has avaricious, wasteful contractors who fund the campaigns of these congressmen. Second, members of Congress see the military expenditures as a jobs program back in their states and districts. You make all these weapons and boom, you blow them up, you use them up, got to make more. Wow, instant jobs. Yeah, for a while. It has been proven by various national economists that was a belief that was held for decades in the 20th century. But by the end of the 1960s, it was quite obvious. And in the 70s, maybe it was clearly stated by economists who did the research that the continuing war did not help our economy in all kinds of ways. So it's not true that war always helps the economy. It helps the sales of commercials on Fox News. We know that. They love it. But it doesn't help the economy as a whole. It wastes our natural resources. It wastes our human resources, too. And if it goes on forever to no desired outcome for anyone, then it's no good. That's my comment. Back to the statement from Ralph Nader here. Finally, members of Congress are not getting any heat, any resistance from the detached, indifferent voters, with a few exceptions, he says, either during or between elections. Notice there is never a debate by candidates on the military budget, how it is used or misused financially and strategically. Yet candidates regularly pledge ever-increasing dollars for the defense budget. As a final cruel insult to our children and grandchildren, Congress, by refusing to fund the wars as they persist, has built up a huge deficit for future generations of Americans to pay. All our time in Iraq and Afghanistan, we borrowed money. That's why we're so many trillions of dollars in debt, mostly to China. Because we didn't have it. Nobody else had any money to even loan us. Is that right? I'm just asking. Okay. Back to the comment from Ralph Nader. He says, retired Colonel Andrew Bosovich has written, quote, a people untouched or seemingly untouched by war are far less likely to care about it. Persuaded that they have no skin in the game, they will permit the state to do whatever it wishes to do, unquote. Nader concludes, but collectively we all have skin in the game. Look at the unmet needs in our country, crumbling infrastructure, toxic environments, and the corrosive cost of corporatism escaping law enforcement that would protect consumers and workers. So he hopes that we contact our congressmen, congresspeople, and raise some of those questions. President, just as my comment, of course, you're aware that President Donald Trump suggested when he was campaigning, before he was president, that these foreign wars, foreign involvements, weren't really necessary. And they had no good purpose. And they cost us a fortune. And now he's in office. He's sending over the mother of all bombs and hundreds of millions, was it $59 million in that little attack on a runway, an airport runway in Syria that they got back into use 2 hours after the attack. So, thank you very much. And, you know, a lot of the media are a parcel of this. They have to do a report, and they're encouraged to give their opinions these days. Wow, did you see that bomb blow up? Wasn't that something? Hey, it's not the 4th of July fireworks, folks. We're talking about, first of all, the taxpayers' money. And secondly, we're talking about a lot of lives being ended. And usually a good number are innocent lives, too, in these wars and battles. And we're not seen, as Ralph Nader points out, as liberators over there at all. We're the people that do the big bribes, that give money away. Packs and packs and suitcases full of $100 U.S. bills. Not exactly, but of course President Trump did propose in the budget that he submitted $54 billion more support for the Defense Department. He hadn't suggested we stop any of these military incursions. So many contradictions there. But let's look at local news, huh? We're halfway through. Let me control my emotions a little bit here. Here's a comment from Jack Lessenberry that we'll share with you about it was the announcement this week that Dan Kildee, who's a representative to the U.S. Congress from the Flint area, has decided not to run for governor as a Democrat. But, of course, we already have several other candidates, so you might want to listen to that. It's not a campaign ad for Democrats, but we're fairly sure it's going to be our state attorney general, Bill Schuette, that's going to be the leading Republican whose name is out there, who probably get the nomination for the Republicans. And there is an election, not this year, remember, but next year, 2018 November, is when we will be having to make a choice on our next governor in Michigan. But listen to Lessenberry's assessment of the Democratic candidates. And we'll be back with local, I promise you, local news from Dearborn and the surrounding areas. The WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint has decided that he will not, after all, run for the Democratic nomination for governor next year. Sources close to the congressman told me last night that he'd been wavering until last week when House Republicans rammed through a health care bill that few understood and which made Democrats extremely mad. Kildee, who's told me he loves Congress, had an epiphany then that his work was to stay in the House, where he has a safe seat, and fight for what is right for the nation. That's certainly understandable, and it's conceivable that within a decade, he could be a major power in Congress. His decision leaves Gretchen Whitmer, the former Senate Minority Leader, as the presumptive nominee, fully 15 months before the Democratic primary. Now, there are other candidates for the nomination, four of them totally unknown, including an emergency services driver and a retired Xerox executive. The way things look now, the closest thing to serious competition she faces is a challenge from Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, the former head of the Detroit Health Department. El-Sayed is brilliant and a clear and forceful speaker. He's both a medical doctor and a doctor of philosophy, an accomplished athlete who attended Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. He did more than is generally known to improve public health in Detroit. And what may be most astonishing of all is that he's only 32 years old. But he faces two enormous handicaps. First, he's never run for anything before. That was also the case with Rick Snyder, and it's clear that made him a weaker governor. More serious is one that many would find it taboo to mention. El-Sayed is a Muslim with an Arabic name. Last fall, Democrats nominated the well-known and much-beloved Ismail Ahmed to a seat on the fairly low-profile State Board of Education. Ahmed was hugely qualified and about as American as apple pie, but he ran almost 250,000 votes behind the other Democratic nominee for one reason only. Many voters were unwilling to vote for an Arab and a Muslim. I found that terribly unfair. But there's no reason to believe those attitudes are going to change anytime soon, and there could be even more reluctance to vote for a Muslim for governor. This race may not, however, be as over as it seems. There are still many months ahead. Over the weekend, someone sent me a little-known gubernatorial poll the respected firm Target Insight did in March. It included a familiar name that we haven't heard much this cycle. It found that in a mythical Democratic primary matchup, Whitmer would have gotten 27% of the vote to 17% for Kildee, while a further 28% were undecided. But another 28% opted for a different name. They chose the controversial and flamboyant attorney Jeffrey Figer. What's more, the poll showed Figer beating Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette, the most likely Republican nominee, 41-39%. Those numbers are all within the margin of error. It's way early. There's absolutely no indication that Figer, their disastrous nominee 20 years ago, has any interest in running. But in politics, as in life, you never can tell.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
Always check out michiganradio.org. It's a great resource for news about the cities in Michigan, as well as state issues in Lansing that you just don't get coverage anywhere else. Highly recommend that if you've got a computer access. Okay, looking at the Dearborn Heights Times-Herald from Wednesday, May 10th, 2 days ago, former city clerk Kathleen Buda has pled not guilty to 7 felony counts of embezzlement and common law offenses. That was back on May 5th, last Friday, in Wayne County Circuit Court. Her plea was given during an arraignment on information in front of Judge Gregory Bill. A pretrial conference was set for 9 a.m. May 17th in Circuit Court. We have given the background of that. She's charged with embezzlement. I don't know if you call it, embezzlement, right, by a public official. And there's a couple different charges there, but embezzlement comes with a maximum of 10 years in prison or a $5,000 fine. Each count of larceny in a building has a maximum of 4 years in jail or a $5,000 fine. And each count of misconduct in office comes with a maximum of 5 years in jail or a $10,000 fine. So, could be serious consequences if she's proven guilty. She has asked for a trial, and she's pleading not guilty to get her day in court, and that's certainly her right. Just want to let you know on that. Of course, we're just finished a graduation here at Henry Ford College. I do know, and just quickly will mention, that we graduated our first 4-year degree students. Of course, that's one reason that we did change our name from Henry Ford Community College, Henry Ford College. We have a 4-year degree program, and perhaps a couple more. I don't know what the state legislature is doing, dragging its feet on the Allied Health 4-year degree, because it's the right thing to do for the whole state of Michigan. They've admitted that before, but I guess they got other priorities up there in Lansing. I thought it was exciting to mention, too, that the 6th graduating class of Henry Ford Early College exit with 2 debt-free diplomas ready for work. So here's the story. So that's part of our graduation, but it's the Henry Ford Early College. Hats and tassels will cloud the skies of Dearborn May 11th. That was yesterday, folks. The paper came out Wednesday. As students of Henry Ford Early College became that school's 6th graduating class, the program began in 2007, preparing students for a career in the healthcare industries through a unique curriculum that takes students through the 9th to 13th grades. Students not only graduate with a high school diploma, but also a 2-year associate degree or a certification in a healthcare field. That was started by Dearborn Public Schools, but it's open to high school students throughout Wayne County. Now, we do have another program here that is a Head Start program for only Dearborn students. And the name of that program is slightly different. But this is the Henry Ford Early College program, which you would think would apply to all of those programs, but this one has a focus on the field of healthcare. Okay, so you can be in high school, and you can work at Henry Ford College on your degree here, and it costs very little, especially if you're a Dearborn resident. Okay, So it's, you know, congratulations to all those graduates. Here's the name at the end of the article. Always read these articles all the way through if you find them interesting. Other extended learning options offered by the district include the Henry Ford Collegiate Academy. That's the name I wanted. And also the Michael Berry Career Center. So there's a couple of different options that are related to the Henry Ford College and the Dearborn Public Schools for advanced placement or advanced career training and so on. And those are great, great options, and all students should consider them to see if they're right for them, of course. Okay, move on from there to the Dearborn Press and Guide from also this Wednesday, May the 10th. Just a brief mention also, Dearborn Heights School District number 7 has gone through a lot of school superintendents in recent years. Their new one has just been appointed, Jennifer Mast. She was chosen back on May 2nd to lead the district. And it's had, you know, the district has had three leaders, three different superintendents in the last 3 years. Mass has served as the interim superintendent since April 1st and officially will begin the permanent post July 1st. District number 7, by the way, has about 3,000 students, and good luck to them. Okay. I'm not sure why there was the revolving door sort of on so many superintendents. It's only 3,000 students. How tough a superintendent job can it be? Well, of course, you want to give quality attention to all 3,000, but I'm just saying Dearborn Public Schools has, what, 20, 25,000 students altogether? Is that too many? Well, anyway, coming up on May 20th, we always give some events mention here, especially if they're nonprofits. On May 20th, and that is a week from tomorrow, it's on Saturday, a week from tomorrow, is the 36th Annual Dearborn Symphony Home Tour. It's going to be in the Highland and Howard Park neighborhoods. And it will be a walk from one house to the other, and you can get more information on that. It's a fundraising event, of course. It's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on May 20th, as I said. You can get tickets in advance for $16 or $21 the day of the tour. The organization website is dearbornsymphony-friends.org. It's probably a link from the DearbornSymphony.org website, I would assume. But it's DearbornSymphony-Friends.org for more information on that. Okay, the new WHFR Journal. Pages turning on the air. Absolutely. That's the way we do it here. That's how we run. I found this story from the NewsHerald.com website, and it's a very complete story. I wanted to report to you about the election results. For whatever reason, excuse me, even though Dearborn Heights is having election for mayor and city council members, as many other cities in this area and throughout Michigan are going to have this. Well, there's a primary in August, and there's a election. The big election is in November. But Wyandotte just did theirs. Yeah, it's all over and done with. So here's the story from Sue Suchita, who usually does theater reviews, but she did a great job writing this, and it's a little long. But anyway, I'll just summarize. Mayor Joseph Peterson was reelected. He got 80% of the vote. Councilwoman Sherry Sutherby Frick was term limited, couldn't run another term as councilperson there. They have term limits on their council people. We don't in Dearborn. I'm not in favor of term limits anyway, but nonetheless, she ran against the mayor and did not win. But on the council, two councilmen did return, Leonard Sabuda and Donald Schultz. They were incumbents, along with Robert DeSena. DeSena, he was a former councilman. He had served before, but wasn't in the, you know, elected last time around, I guess. And he returned to the body. So we got three people that have experience at being city council members. And then newcomers that got elected were Megan Miani, Chris Calvin, Robert Alderman. There was two incumbents that did not get reelected. So they got three newbies, and two of the incumbents didn't get reelected. One of the big issues down there, apparently, throughout the article, it's mentioned, although not explained, is opposition or support for the McKinley School Project. It seems that the issue, in reading later, is that that was a vacant piece of property, and would the city put up $7.5 million for development? And some people were against that. One of the people who didn't get elected, an incumbent that didn't get elected, said it was his opposition to that that people held against him. So apparently they've got $7.5 million, and the there is a desire, by the results of the votes anyway, for city council to proceed with that development project. I'm not sure what is planned as development. Maybe it takes $7.5 million just to clear the McKinley School building out of there so other things can happen. Don't know about that. Interestingly, that the person who was elected as the assessor, the city assessor, Theodore Galeski, he said that, I wonder if he's related to the incumbent who lost, Daniel Galeski. But he said he thought his election was a reflection of voters' desire to have a certified professional in that position. So there you are. There is a certificate, a licensing procedure, perhaps, to become an assessor in Michigan. And apparently, from what he implies, some people are city assessors and don't have the certificate. It doesn't mean they don't know what to do, but I'm just saying that's an interesting fact, and I wasn't aware that there was a certificate that was available to people who are assessors. One of the new people elected, Chris Calvin, was a former school board member, so he knows that about how to do meetings and make things happen and so on. Calvin said he'd like to look into the idea of bringing a hotel to downtown Wyandotte. Apparently, they don't have a hotel down there in Wyandotte, at least along 4th Street and one of those other streets, too. I haven't been down there in a while. Sorry. But they do have all kinds of different food venues and all kinds of stores. And, you know, they have a big art fair every summer. And if you go to that, you can go up and down the main streets there and see everything that's going on. It's really a pretty active downtown area, but they don't have a hotel there. So he was suggesting that maybe something be done like that. They also say that the old City Hall could be a potential site for a new downtown hotel. Oh, they've got a new City Hall, too. I didn't know that. And the old one is just sitting vacant, sort of like Allen Park. They moved into a former office building because they couldn't afford the repairs of their, well, it looks beautiful from the outside, beautiful City Hall that they had for decades right along Southfield Expressway there at the end of Southfield Expressway as it turns eastward. But they couldn't afford to repair it, so they just left it. So it's vacant there. I'm sure they'd like to sell that land for some other purpose. But it looks like Wyandotte had an old City Hall and now have a new City Hall, I guess. And just to also comment, mentioned here in the extended article that the new city council has a very diverse demographic. A resident pointed out that there's female representation, younger representation, and veterans representation. And so she thinks there's good hopes for that group working together and getting all kinds of points of view to make things happen for Wyandotte. So good luck to them. And now I'm looking at one of the bigger stories, I guess, here in Dearborn for the Press and Guide. And I know it was also in the Arab American News for this weekend. Parents accuse Woodworth Middle School teacher of trying to convert students to Christianity in a world religion class. Now, so this is middle school, and I think I'm scanning it here to make it briefer, seventh grade teacher. And she was spending a week in a world religion class. You divvy up the time to the major world religions, and depending how you look at them, there's at least four that I can name, but maybe seven or eight that are significant influencing the world. And, of course, there's hundreds of different organized religions, but in that kind of class. And I'm first of all, in terms of the story, I didn't know we had a world religion class in our schools. Usually, and certainly we have a whole program, we have a whole degree program in world religion studies here at Henry Ford College, and most four-year schools have, of course, extensive four-year programs. And usually it implies you have a good background in philosophy in order to understand the dogma, no disrespect there, but that is the specific teachings of the religion. They sometimes have a philosophical, ethical base. They say they always do. I'm sorry, no disrespect to organized religions, but I'm just, you know, you can critique them from the outside a little bit. Anyway, the students felt that maybe the teacher was pushing a little too hard about how good Christianity was, and the teacher apparently was Christian. But the problem I see, the big problem that really upset the students in class, was she showed a clip from the movie The Passion of Christ, and it's an R-rated film. I think that was Mel Gibson's film, primarily about the torturing of the historical Jesus before he was, and his, you know, death on the cross, and of course, rising afterwards from death to heaven, if you want to accept the that particular story. But the Passion of Christ was critiqued as a very unnecessarily violent movie. Mel Gibson is really, really one of the Christian, he's a Christian that just loves, apparently, the suffering of Christ to be portrayed in the most violent and awful way, and perhaps it was for the historical Jesus. We weren't there. There was no documentary cameras. But to show this to a seventh grade class, which I'm pretty sure it was seventh grade here, that's 12-year-olds, I wouldn't want that. And it has nothing to do with whether it was supporting Christianity or not. In fact, I think that movie would turn off a lot of people rather than convert them. I don't think it was appropriate at all. Apparently, this teacher started with the Dearborn Schools only in January of this year, although she had taught at a charter school for a year and a half before that. So it's a relatively new teacher. And charter schools don't have the same sort of requirements, don't have the same testing rules. And so I don't know what happened there, but, there were complaints to the Board of Education in Dearborn at their last meeting, and the superintendent and the other trustees there said that, there'll be a thorough investigation. But it seems to me yours truly, that The Passion of Christ, even just clips from it, is way too violent, even for some adults, to be shown, no matter what religion you're part of. But that will be investigated. I think the Dearborn Public Schools will, I have a lot of trust that they'll do the right thing now it's been brought to their attention. Okay. Oh, my goodness. It's about 8 minutes to 2 o'clock, and at 2 o'clock, Kitty Love is in the studio, and Highway 61 Blues Show will be starting up at 2 and going to 4 today at 4 o'clock. Mike Holloway and Go With The Flow Blues Show is going to be from 4 to 6, so your big Thank Goodness It's Friday Blues Afternoon will be starting up in just a few minutes. So let me toss some other ideas out here. Let's see. Okay. Just picking this one, I guess. Tomorrow night at the Redford Theater. That's a nonprofit organization, by the way. They show a wide variety of different movies and films. They have all different kinds of events. They have a lot of volunteers helping them, just like WHFR does. Couldn't do it with all of our volunteer staff. But tomorrow night, and it might be sold out already, but you need to go to the website of, if you want to attend their movie tomorrow night, they're showing a documentary film that's not glossy or fancy. It's not a Hollywood production. It's called 12th in Claremont. As it says here in their press release, no stars, no acting. It is a gritty documentary about the 1967 riots that that happened in the city of Detroit in 1967, produced by the Detroit Free Press in collaboration with Bridge Magazine, remember that news organization in Ann Arbor, I highly recommend to you, and WXYZ TV Channel 7. So it consists solely of 8mm movie footage submitted by Detroit residents, supplemented by old news film, all paired with the voices of unidentified interview subjects. If you were born after 1967, it's important that you understand what happened and why. If you lived through it, you will see it in a way that most people only heard or read about it. So it's going to be their movie at the Redford Theater, one night only, just tomorrow night, May 13th at 8 p.m. All of the previous showings during the Free Press Film Festival were sellouts and completely sold out. You can buy tickets online once you go to their website. And just have to look, Redford Theater, R-E-D-F-O-R-D. And because it's not on, is it on the press release somewhere? Let me go to the end. Nope. But it's easy to search for that. You know it is. Yeah. Use your favorite search engine. So highly recommend that. I have not seen it, but excellent reviews. I was alive and, in fact, driving through Detroit the morning of the riot. I was coming home late after a date. Turned on the radio, and things were already starting to happen. I think it was about 4 or 5 a.m. And then, of course, we watched TV. And I don't have time to go into all my personal recollections, but it was a difficult time. And it wasn't just in Detroit that year. You know, there's a lot of things happening in the whole country. There was some discussion by Larry Gabriel in the Metro Times issue from this week, from May 10th, it stated anyway, because the question came up there because of a column he wrote a week ago, and the email question to him was, why are we still obsessed with 1967? You know, it's sort of thing like, get past it. You know, a long time ago, 50 years ago, we got problems today. Let's deal with those. And I understand that. But he has a good, really good response. It's a little too long for the time that I have remaining in the story. But remember, the Metro Times newspaper, and you can find it in a variety of places around town. It's free. Okay? So you should read every week their investigative and opinion pieces. I think it's a... You can't beat the price, let me put it that way. And this opinion about 1967 and why it still should be important to us is very well done by Larry Gabriel. Okay. What else we have here? Some more events happening. I'll just conclude with events. Okay, you can relax. We're done with the heavy-duty political social comments, except this has a little bit of that. Tomorrow, also. That's today. Okay. The new Q line of streetcars in Detroit are open to the public starting today, but this whole weekend there's going to be a Q line Detroit festival from 6 to 10 p.m., only at night. Events are planned at all the route stops, and shops located near the route will offer discounts and other promotions. You can go to their website, which probably has Q line somewhere in the headings. And again, this press release does not, it always has a link. I did print out the entire schedule, and oh my gosh, there's all kinds of things happening at every single line. The Baltimore Street Station, Amsterdam Station, Ferry Street Station, it's all along Woodward Avenue in Detroit. And it's free to ride, and then you can get off wherever you want to at these stops, and there's just different discounts and happy hours and special events, a lot of them free, most cost a little bit of money. Just go down a list here, and it depends. If you don't have the schedule, some of these events are today, tonight, some are tomorrow, and there's some on Sunday. But not quite as many on Sunday, but nonetheless, maybe because it's Mother's Day and they think there won't be as many mothers riding the line. I'm just hop, skipping, and jump through some of the venues. Hotel St. Regis, Happy's Pizza, A New Life Prosthetics and Orthotics. Wow, Robbie's Shoes, Detroit Hardware Company, Z's Villa, Mel Salon and Associates, College for Creative Studies, of course, Detroit Historical Society, of course, Domino's Pizza down there, jumping down, Detroit Institute of Arts, Maccabees Traders, Michigan Science Center, Wayne State University Press, Sweet Lorraine's Mac and Brews. Yes, I know Sweet Lorraine's from their other locations. CompuWare, the Whitney, Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, Hopcat Detroit. Ooh, they got a BOGO brunch on Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Must show Q-Line promotional item to receive offer for two guests only. I love brunches. I love brunches. Oh, there's a Source Booksellers on the line. Michigan State University has a branch down there. Detroit Symphony Orchestra, of course, they've got things happening too. And it's a big long list. That's only the first page. So there's, let's see, Woodhouse Day Spa, Detroit Comedy Underground. And again, this is not the inclusive list. It just goes on and on. How many things you can see and do at or near the Q line. And you say, well, where do I get on it? You can get downtown Detroit at Congress Street or just north of Congress Street. The Q line starts. It runs on both sides, both east, you know, the east side and the west side. I'm not sure what, I assume the east side goes north and the west side comes south along there. And it goes all the way up past I-94 to Baltimore Street. That's the north extension there. It goes all the way through the New Center neighborhood. From Baltimore Street, north of I-94 in Woodward, all the way down through Midtown, of course, the infamous Warren Avenue, Canfield Street, Mack Avenue, and not infamous. People use that word wrong. Infamous is public disgrace. So I should just say famous. Okay, say famous, and then it's correct. I always hear that, and I'm always sometimes making the mistake myself. All right, real quick. Tomorrow also is Letter Carrier's Food Drive everywhere in the whole United States. Put a bag on your porch out tomorrow morning with non-perishable food goods. So like things in boxes or cans or whatever. Put it by your mailbox, and the food carriers will pick it up and deliver it to a local food bank. It's a wonderful thing they do. They don't get paid for the extra work. And you should support that. That is tomorrow, again, Saturday, May 13th. There's also in Dearborn, it's always fun to go and even watch if you don't have a pet, a mutt, a dog that you want to strut out at the Dearborn's Ford Field. And that's going to be going on tomorrow from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Hit the trail with your furry friend and raise money for homeless animals at the Dearborn Animal Shelter, also known as the Friends of the Metro Detroit Animals. So that's the story for now today at the new WHFR Journal. Thank you for tuning in. And come on back next week because things are always happening and you want to find out what's going on and dig deeper. Now it's time for Highway 61. This is WHFR Dearborn.